fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
That first hour was very, very interesting in the fact that Judith Barry Baker gave a firsthand, witnessing of her relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald. There's no one to dispute that. This goes back to her own, you could say, integrity and her truth saying and her honesty, and I believe she has all of that and more. She has nothing really to gain, and there's so much evidence now, especially concerning the JFK, that it was a conspiracy of gigantic proportions. Jim Mars in Crossfire has done the best job, and he's going to be following this introduction and commentary that I'm giving now. And he's going to get in to really a lot of different factors on the JFK, but also the world in general. He's written a book back here on the date that Charlotte Littlefield and I interviewed Jim Mars on December 6th, 2008, and that's what this second hour is. It's a broadcast, a rebroadcast. The first hour, reiterating again, was my interview let me go back. The first hour started out with 7 minutes, and that 7 minutes was Lee Harvey Oswald being quizzed as he's being walked through the Dallas Police Department, and he's maintaining that he's innocent and not guilty of anything, of any murder or any such thing. The remaining part of that hour, it was an interview that I had with Judith Barry Baker. And Judith Barry Baker was involved romantically with Lee Harvey Oswald in addition to doing being part of a secret project that was building a cancer virus that was going to be smuggled in and given to Fidel Castro to assassinate him. But also Lee Harvey Oswald knew about this special secret project in New Orleans. There's been another book written about this, Dr. Mary's Monkey by Ed Haslam, that was a long-term resident of New Orleans, and he has quite a few insights into that also. So you might check that out. Go to Trine Day, T-R-I-N-E, Day Publishers, on the web, and you'll be able to see gain some of these insights of these different eyewitness accounts. And these are first-party eyewitness accounts written from the first person. Lee Harvey Oswald was set up by a group that was out to take out JFK. Philosophically and politically, he was going against their wishes. They wanted to maintain a very strong America from a very right wing type of basis, Minuteman type things. They believed that JFK was deserting them on many fronts. He was going to pull out our troops out of Vietnam. These were men of industry and military industrial complex people. By the time that they got rid of JFK, there were a lot of different factions working together, organized crime along with the CIA and other type dark operations units, FBI units that were secret and so forth. So they came together on the Dallas, and this is what's so disheartening in a way. It was that It was a coup, all right, but it wasn't strictly military. There were different factions from the different elements and interests that were involved. And I think Jim Mars lays it out excellently in his writings over the years. But also, Judith Vary Baker, in the first hour, I mean, she was deeply in love with Lee Harvey Oswald. They had met in New Orleans. Both were married at the time. And I think Judith Vary Baker had just gotten married. And I think Lee Harvey Oswald had been married for a number of years at that time, or at least over several years. I don't have the exact time that he'd been married at the time. But both were married, and then they became involved with each other in a New Orleans where you had organized crime and Carlos Marcello, and you had David Perry, and you had Clay Shaw, and you had Guy Bannister. You had so many different individuals there that were confluent. And then Guy Bannister was running the Mongoose Project, which was a secret project to take out Fidel Castro using a bunch of Cuban nationalists. So there again, you had them clashing with Lee Harvey Oswald, who supposedly was pro-Castro, handing out leaflets and booklets on the streets of New Orleans for pro-Cuba, pro-Cubana. But what was interesting, and I brought that up during the first hour, was that Carlos Lamont was the author of about a 40-page booklet that Lee Harvey Oswald had been given to him by the CIA. And that booklet was pro-Soviet all the way, written by Carlos Lamont. Well, now, here's a connection that I uncovered over the years. In Carlos Lamont's father, Thomas W. Lamont, was the first vice president of J.P. Morgan, and he was sent down to Jekyll Island to make the deal on behalf of J.P. Morgan for those international financial interests that took over our Federal, set up and established the Federal Reserve, which established a monopoly of money creation in this country through centralized fractional banking through that central bank called the Federal Reserve System. So this is mirroring an exact mirroring image of the Fabian Society in the 1880s in England that was set up by the rich to bring about a socialist communist state to UK, which they have pretty well done by now. Minimum socialist for sure, very very socialist. So that's basically the technique of the ultra rich out there are to set up a controlled opposition, such as a collectivist type of dynamic, and infiltrate it and control it and fund it. And then also, it debilitates people. It weakens people when you look to the government and you no longer look to individual, entrepreneurship and so forth. The three clips that I am going to play here are going to be Warren Buffett. Start off here and just to correct myself a second. Yeah, I'm going to play three different clips, okay? And Warren Buffett is saying, oh, he's totally okay in support of Hillary. And then there's another clip there, but that comes before that, that has Riley with Krauthammer talking about the inadequacy and so forth, and the criticism that Panetta has lodged against our president at this time. And the last clip is a clip that is being the Federal Reserve official, the comptroller of the Federal Reserve, is being quizzed by missing trillions of dollars. This is not just 1 trillion, but it's multiple trillions of dollars that are missing. And she has no real answer. So anyway, listen to those three clips, and then I hope that you enjoy the rebroadcast of our December 6, 2008 Jim Mars interview. And we get into the JFK and a lot of other little offshoots that should prove to be very interesting. And I want to wish every one of you a very, very good weekend, and bless all of you. And boy, we just hope you continue to listen to our program. We're bringing you truth, the secret truth, the best way that we know how, and we're not distorting anything or puffing anything, and we're certainly not lying about anything we're doing. Thank you for listening.
Thank you with Leon Panetta joining us from Washington, Charles Krauthammer. So how'd I do?
You did great. Panetta did great. I'm afraid Obama did not do very well.
Explain.
Well, look, Panetta is an icon of the Democratic Party. 20 years, one of the leaders of the party. Everyone knows he's a straight shooter. And you could tell from the tone of his responses to you that he's sympathetic to the president, but he loves his country and he feels he has to say the truth. And what he said, the content of what he said, even though the tone was measured and restrained, was utterly devastating. He was basically saying this president cannot lead, he is indecisive, and he is weak. What was so interesting is it wasn't even in the discussion of Iraq or Afghanistan, but if you, and this won't even be reported, but the thing he said about Ukraine, where he just sort of, you know, he laid out what should be done, what is obvious we have to do, to give Ukraine weapons, which we have not done, to redo and reinvigorate the missile defense agreement with Obama has not done, and to be serious about shoring up the defenses of Eastern Europe. And he said this just outright. You said, why doesn't he do it? He had absolutely no answer. And then, you know, you're trying to get into Obama's head or Panetta's understanding of Obama's head, and he doesn't have an answer. And it, and if you look at it in terms of what's happening in the Middle East, there are two things that come out. It's not just indecisiveness and how tentative Obama is, but it's also how political he is. Remember when Bob Gates wrote his book, he talked about how the decision making about the surge in Afghanistan and then leaving in Afghanistan was essentially dictated by the political types in the White House. And you get the same thing in the Panetta book about Iraq. He knew we had to leave troops in Iraq. It is one of the worst decisions ever made by this president. And you called it a blunder, which of course it is. And the answer of how it came about is that it was the political types in the White House who wanted to go into 2012 with no troops left in Iraq so Obama could say, I ended the war in Iraq. Of course, he didn't end the war in Iraq. Petraeus ended the war in Iraq, and then Obama threw away the fruits of victory. But it was the political nature of that that I think is the biggest indictment of Obama, where he put the White House concerns about the political, partisan fortunes of the president above the national security of the country.
He, of course, doesn't see it that way, the president, because he said, well, I couldn't predict what would happen, that Maliki would screw it up. Now, on the Benghazi front, I mean, Leon Panetta does not believe that the Obama administration purposely misled the country. He rather would believe that they chose Petraeus's talking points over the talking points of the Defense Department and the Pentagon. Do you buy in that?
I think it's plausible. There was a phone. You look at the emails that were exchanged just before the Susan Rice appearance on the Sunday shows. There was a lot of political infighting, a lot of blame shifting. Remember the memo that said this building, meaning the State Department, doesn't like the talking points as they are now, trying to protect the Secretary of State, trying to protect the Defense Department. So I could understand that. But I do think the major point is this, again, is driven by the White House, by political considerations. You've got 2 months to go until an election. The meme, the theme of your election campaign is I killed Osama, and the war against terror is essentially won.
Right.
The tide of war is receding, so you have to construct a fable. And they stuck with that. You could say, well, at the beginning they weren't sure, fine. But they stuck with that for days and days.
Okay. Charles Krauthammer, everybody, and one footnote. His book, Things That Matter, has now sold more than 1 million copies. Congratulations to Charles.
A question of very great interest to this audience. Is Hillary going to run? Now, let me give you a background on Hillary, because in 2008, Warren promised support to both Hillary and Barack Obama. And then when he found out that he'd done that sort of, he said, well, okay, I'll just be a bigamist. So he did back
the only time I've been a bigamist.
Okay, tell us, is Hillary going to run?
Hillary's going to run.
Hillary's going to run. Yeah. How soon is she going to announce it?
She's going to announce it as late as possible.
Uh-huh. Well, how late is late as possible?
Well, I'm giving a direct quote.
Okay. All right. Next question. Who's going to be your opponent? Who would you get?
I don't know. The interesting thing is that Mitt Romney's getting more interested.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But her opponent will be whoever wins the Republican primary, and there's going to be a lot of people who want to do it.
Well, some people say that if Jeb Bush runs, that Mitt Romney won't. Do you believe that's the case?
I think once they have the political bug, anybody will run that they think can get it, has a chance, mm-hmm. and who thinks they can raise the money.
Okay.
That's called Buffett's Law.
Now, final question on that. Is Hillary going to win?
Hillary's going to win. Yeah.
Well, I know I've heard just in the last few days that some of the political pundits like Ed Rollins are saying that it is going to be true.
Right? I will bet money on it.
Bet money.
I don't do that easily.
Anybody in the audience who would like to come on the other side of Warren Buffett?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Inspector Coleman, you're the Inspector General for the Federal Reserve, right? Okay.
That's correct.
Have you done any investigations concerning the Federal Reserve's role in deciding not to save Lehman Brothers, which led to shockwaves that went through the entire financial system?
In that particular area, I don't generally comment on specific investigations, but we do not currently have an investigation in that particular area.
All right. What about the $1 trillion plus in expansion of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet since last September? Have you conducted any investigations regarding that?
Right now we have a review, and I don't know if the term investigation may have different connotations. So we're actually conducting a fairly high-level review of the various lending facilities collectively, which would include the TALF, a variety of the different programs that are in process. So we're looking at them at a fairly high level to identify risk.
Well, I understand that, but we're talking about events that started unfolding 8 months ago. Have you reached any conclusions about the Fed expanding its balance sheet by over $1 trillion since last September?
We have not yet reached any conclusions.
Do you know who received that money?
We're in the process right now of doing our review, and
right, but you're the Inspector General. My question to you specifically is, do you know who received that $1 trillion plus that the Fed extended and put on its balance sheet since last September? Do you know the identity of the recipients?
I do not know. We have not looked at that specific area at this particular point on those reviews.
What about Bloomberg's report that there are trillions of dollars in off-balance sheets transactions that the Federal Reserve has entered into since last September? Are you familiar with those off-balance sheet transactions?
I think it may be important at this point, too, just to bring up a certain aspect related to our jurisdiction. And just to clarify perhaps some of my earlier comments, we are the Inspector General for the Board of Governors, and we have direct oversight over board programs and operations, and are also able to look at board-delegated functions to the Reserve Banks, as well as the board's oversight and supervision of the Reserve Banks. We do not have jurisdiction to directly go out and audit Reserve Bank activities specifically. Nevertheless, in our lending facilities project, for example, we are looking at the board's oversight over the program, and to the extent that extends out to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Well, I have a copy of the Inspector General Act here in front of me, and it says, among other things, that it's your responsibility to conduct and supervise audits and investigations relating to the programs and operations of your agency.
That's correct.
So I'm asking you if your agency has, in fact, according to Bloomberg, extended $9 trillion in credit, which, by the way, works out to $30,000 for every single man, woman, and child in this country. I'd like to know, if you're not responsible for investigating that, who is?
We have responsibility for the Federal Reserve's programs and operations audits, to conduct audits and investigations in that area. In terms of who's responsible for investigating, would you mind repeating the question one more time?
What have you done to investigate the off-balance sheet transactions conducted by the Federal Reserve, which, according to Bloomberg, now total $9 trillion in the last 8 months?
I'll have to look specifically at that Bloomberg article. I don't know if I have actually seen that particular one.
That's not the point. The question is, have you done any investigation or auditing of off-balance sheet transactions conducted by the Federal Reserve?
At this point, we're conducting our lending facility project at a fairly high level and have not gotten to a specific level of detail to really be in a position to respond to your question.
Have you conducted any investigation or auditing of the losses that the Federal Reserve has experienced on its lending since last September?
We're still in the process of conducting that review. Until we actually, you know, go out and gather the information, I'm not in a position to really respond to the specific question.
So are you telling me that nobody at the Federal Reserve is keeping track on a regular basis of the losses that it incurs on what is now a $2 trillion portfolio?
I don't know if you're telling me that you're mentioning that there's losses. I'm just saying that we're not, until we actually look at the program and have the information, we are not in a position to say whether there are losses or to respond in any other way to that.
Mr. Chairman, my time is up, but I have to tell you honestly, I am shocked to find out that nobody at the Federal Reserve, including the Inspector General, is keeping track of this.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield.
How are you doing tonight, Charlotte? You okay?
Yeah, I'm doing good, George. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, that's great. We've got a really fine guest tonight. Jim Morris is his name, and he's written, I guess, 8 or 10 books. I've got to get an exact count from him here in just a few moments. He's a native of Fort Worth, Texas. He's taught courses at the university up there. He started his reporting background at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And let's bring him on and let him tell us a little bit about his background. Welcome to our program, Jim Morris.
Hey, George and Charlotte, it's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, I consider it an honor, Jim Morris, for you to be with us this evening.
Well, the honor's all mine, and I particularly honor any of your listeners, because anybody who's listening to a show that is throwing out information and raising issues, that means their mind's open and their eyes and ears are open, and I honor each and every one of those folks.
How did you first get started in your writing career on these books and so forth? Did it start with just one book or an idea or some kind of a seed of some kind, or was it the JFK thing or what?
Or weren't you also an Army intelligence writer?
Well, no, I didn't do any writing when I was in Army intelligence. That goes all the way back. Actually, I've been, ever since, I don't know, junior high school, maybe before that, I've been a curious type, okay? And I always want to know, well, what's really going on, you know? And I came up through a real Ozzie and Harriet background, and so I didn't have any axes to grind or agendas to advance. I just want to know what's going on. And when I...
Okay.
Well, sounds like we lost Jim momentarily.
Okay, bring him back up. Yeah, we're interviewing. We've lost temporarily Jim Morris on the line there. But anyway, he's written quite a few books, Above Top Secret.
Of course, if the listeners go to thesecrettruth.com, they can read how he was, he became a military and aerospace writer for the newspaper and an investigative reporter following the Vietnam War, I believe.
Yeah, I think he was in intelligence. He was with the 4th Army Intelligence Unit in Vietnam. And then he went into writing on aerospace and so forth. And as an investigative reporter, since about 1980, he's been a freelance writer and author and public relations consultant. But he's written such titles. These are some of the books he's written: Above Top Secret, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, The Terror Conspiracy Deception, 9/11, and The Loss of Liberty. Okay. Welcome back, Jim Morris.
Hey, I'm sorry. I don't think I did anything, but I guess somebody pushed a button someplace.
I don't know where you left off,
but I'll try to make it a lot briefer this time.
Well, Jim, I want to know what's going on. You know what they did? They put your unit and my unit together in INSCOM. You know what I mean? I was in the ASA. You were intelligence on it.
Yeah, the Intelligence Security Command.
Yeah. So they put your unit together with mine, and they merged them together. I don't know who's pulling the buttons out there.
I don't either. Well, hey, let me tell you, Dad, don't think my Army Intelligence service was anything too great. They not only did away with my old unit, they did away with the whole Army that I was with. I was part of the old 4th Army. They did away with the whole Army.
You're telling off on yourself, Jim.
I know. I'm kind of telling my age. So, but I look back and I realize that, you know, going back to 1976, I was asked by the head of continuing education at the University of Texas at Arlington if I'd ever considered teaching a course on the Kennedy assassination. And I said, no, I'd never even thought about that. But the more I thought about it, I thought that was great because, hey, you guys as a talk show host and being on the radio, you know what I'm saying when I say that whether you're on radio, TV, or a newspaper, you never quite have the time or the space to really explain the story and give the details that you'd really like to give. So I started teaching a course on the Kennedy assassination in 1976. And, of course, back then, if you didn't say Oswald did it all by himself, you were considered quite the nut. And then I just continued on. And finally in the late 80s, I decided, well, you know, I don't claim to be an expert, but I've talked to so many people connected to this thing, including Marguerite Oswald, Lee's mother, and Jean de Marnechal, and she and her husband George, the last known close friends of Oswald. In fact, I even met Jack Ruby and was in his club. And I said, you know, I really know a lot about this. And so that led me to write Crossfire, The Plot to Kill Kennedy, which ended up a New York Times bestseller and sold over a million.
Boy, that was an excellent book. De Marnechal was a white Russian, part of that white Russian group, was he not?
That's correct.
Yeah, I've investigated this over the years myself. We were up there last year, Charlotte Littlefield Brown and myself, and I got behind that picket fence, and it's only 55 or 60 feet from the street there. It's pretty close.
You know,
it's right there. You know,
I don't even claim to be an expert shot, but I did grow up in Texas, and I do know about guns, and I can use them. I can make that shot with a pistol.
Exactly.
Oh, and the incline of the hill, gentlemen. Oh, if I remember correctly, the fence was up a little bit higher than it could have easily gone over the windshield.
But also, the street goes down, and so even a shot directly from the front of the car could probably have gotten Kennedy too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's what a lot of people don't realize is that Elm Street along that stretch not only slants downward, but then moves laterally over to towards the south. So if you were, say, near the Triple Underpass or behind that fence on the western edge, when he turns that corner, he's heading at you, he's like almost eye level with you. And then as he proceeds on down, he gets further and further down from your position, but he gets closer and closer. It's really a very close place.
Yes, it is. You have this latest book. Have you made sort of a conclusion in different areas and different assertions over the total number of different books you've written over the last few years, or what?
Or were you just surfing the internet looking for good conspiracy?
No. That's the latest book, Above Top Secret, where I tackle about 19 of the top conspiracies and stuff. These are all issues for the most part. There are one or two that I had to do some kind of bring myself up to speed on, but for the most part, these are stories and issues that I've dug into and studied for a number of years. And for example, in the Kennedy assassination, everybody is still on the grassy knoll, you know.
Okay.
Was there a gunman there or was there not? Well, let me just put it this way. If this was any other criminal case other than the Kennedy assassination, and you had a number of witnesses who said a shot came from behind the fence, you had a photograph of a man firing a weapon from behind the fence, you had acoustical studies that said at least one shot came from behind the fence, if I tried to say there was nobody behind the fence, I'd be considered an idiot. But this is the Kennedy assassination.
Jim Mars, you just laid out a good case there. You
know
that? Right. You ought to be an attorney.
This is the Kennedy assassination. And, of course, the cover-up has not been classic cover-up in the sense that there's no information. It's been quite the opposite, obfuscation. There's just so much smoke and so many charge and counter-charge and theory and anti-theory that the average person just says, oh, man, I don't think I want to hear any more about it.
Now, John J. McCarthy, one of the most powerful men sitting on the Warren Commission, and he had relations with all the independent oil companies and the mainline oil company. We'll be right back. We have to take a break. Thank you very much, Jim.
7 weeks, but you could be waiting for a day that won't come.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Littlefield, and welcome back, Jim Mars, to The Secret Truth.
Hey, it's good to be going again.
can we tick off some of these things on out of your latest book, Above Top Secret, real quick and sort of get some real quick? Because we'd like to put as much into these 2 hours as we can.
Can I wrap up the Kennedy assassination?
Sure. Excuse me. Oh, yeah, that's one of them right there.
You know, because, you know, interestingly enough, guys, I find that there is still quite a lot of public interest in the assassination, and I think the reason for that is because obviously it has not yet been solved to everyone's satisfaction. But what I want to point out is that so many people are still stuck on the grassy knoll. You know, how many gunmen, how many shots, which shot hit where, all this stuff. You know, we may never know that for certain. They've tried to show these programs on Discovery and History and various channels and ABC, and they do these computer simulations. They go, oh, look, it's perfectly possible that Oswald fired the one shot and hit both Kennedy and Connolly. And yeah, I'll be the first to admit, yeah, that's, you know, somehow theoretically possible. Question is that what happened? And the answer is clearly no, because not that we can prove who did what shot or from what distance or whatever. But what we can prove beyond any reasonable shadow of a doubt is that the truth of the Kennedy assassination has been covered up at the level, high levels within the federal government of the United States. You mentioned John J. McCloy. He's mixed up in all kinds of things. And his protege, Alan Dulles, was one of the longest serving CIA directors who was fired by Kennedy because of the ill-fated Bay of Pigs invasion, and then turned around and sat on the Warren Commission and was one of its most prominent members to decide what happened to him. Now, those guys in the Warren Commission and the FBI, we're talking about major arms of the federal government of the United States. What can be clearly demonstrated and proven is that they suppressed evidence, destroyed evidence, fabricated evidence, and then intimidated witnesses. I've talked to people who told the FBI 2 and 2 is 4, and they go back and write a report and said they said that 2 and 2 is 16. I mean, that is definitely proven. So the fact that there's been a cover-up at the level of the federal government, this is what transforms what at that time was merely a Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat.
Yes, the rise of the Fourth Reich was describing many of those people in that book, was it not? That probably
Yes. You know, when I began to write The Rise of the Fourth Reich, which is about the infiltration of National Socialism, which in the German language, the acronym of which is Nazi, that's where the term Nazi comes from. It's just a short version of National Socialism. And these National Socialists that came over here after the war, some of them were homegrown, some of them were right on Wall Street. They funded Hitler before the war, they funded Hitler during the war, and after the war they brought Nazis into this country and began to infiltrate National Socialism into our national life here in the United States. Now, and I'm not talking about goose-stepping Germans. I'm talking about Wall Street financiers such as Prescott Bush, who was prosecuted by the federal government in late 1942 under the Trading with the Enemies Act for being nothing but a financial front man for Hitler and the Nazis. And I'm talking about the Rockefellers, Standard Oil tankers, were refueling German U-boats in the Caribbean right up until close to the end of the war. We're talking about IBM, which provided the punch cards that allowed the Nazis to move people very efficiently to their concentration camps. General Motors, Ford Motor Company, these are the people we're talking about, and these are the people who now run this country.
Yeah, that's what's so. What did you say, Charlotte?
Oh, I was going to say, what about the famed Project Paperclip? Didn't a lot of the brain power also come and go into the various agencies like NASA and Gordon,
exactly,
and wherever else they ended,
exactly,
up?
Exactly. I think most people who've done any reading at all understand that under programs, and it wasn't just Paperclip, but that was the best known, the best documented. Under Paperclip, we brought in their rocket scientists, Wernher von Braun, Dornberger, and a whole handful of these scientists that had been working on the Nazi V weapons. And then, of course, they became the foundation for our NASA space program. And, of course, you know, and then the Russians had their German scientists. Now, I remember as a kid in the 50s, the joke was that the American and the Russian were arguing, saying, our German scientists are better than your German scientists.
Yeah, they were pulling each arm there on the in Berlin, right?
That's right. That's right. But then it began to move out. It went from the rocket scientists, then got into mind control experts, psychiatrists, psychologists.
Yes,
moved into academia. Some of Bush's top advisors are all trained under a fellow who himself was trained by Nazi psychologists. So, you know, when we accepted their technology under the idea that we needed it to combat the Russians in the Cold War, unfortunately, we also got their Nazi ideology.
Well, I think the White Russians enter in on that also because they had networks previous to during the war that,
right,
knew about the communist threat. See, I think and so the White Russians were in opposition to the communist elements there, and so,
right,
they came back and tried to run some of these networks, I believe, to
that's
further
true. That's very true.
And Demarchide and all those people, they were involved with Lee Harvey Oswald in that running of those cells and stuff.
That's
for,
right, yeah. And Clay Shaw, who Jim Garrison, as district attorney in New Orleans, tried to prosecute in the Kennedy assassination, was connected through his World Trade March to very suspicious organizations in Europe that involved Nazis and pro-Nazis and pro-Nazi royalty and, you know, the whole thing. It's a tangled web, and it's the kind of thing that the mainstream mass media just refuses to look at.
The entities out there that I've studied, it's preposterous how entangled and connected they are right now. Is that sort of your idea, too?
That's absolutely true, and that's how they keep everybody befuddled. See, they keep us distracted, arguing about between liberals and conservatives and Republicans and Democrats, and well, we don't understand.
These cult of personalities that we're supporting fighting each other. Right?
That's right, and we don't understand what Paul Volcker, a former head of the Fed, once said. He said, we control them both.
Well, Greenspan was given an honorary title over there at the Bank of England.
Because we're intimately tied with the Bank of England.
Exactly. Her Majesty's Treasury, he was given a special a post there, an honorary post, after he retired.
And what you'll find in reading my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, is that just a couple of years ago, it became public in England that they had found correspondence from the Queen Mother during World War II in which she said she was perfectly okay with a Nazi occupation of Britain as long as they guaranteed the monarchy.
Yeah, that monarchy's got to go on, right? We got to take another break. Jim, thank you very much. We'll be right back. Thank you. The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield.
Welcome back, Jim Mars.
Well, I'm glad to be back. I guess I'm glad to be anywhere, actually.
Yeah. Well, you're doing great, and you're really a fine investigative reporter and a fine writer. Let's move on. Let's tie the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve, and let's get into some of those relationships very quickly during this segment.
Well, you go back and you find out that actually one of the outfits that I call a secret society or a secretive society is Council on Foreign Relations. It's not really secret. I mean, they have a big office building in New York, and they even publish a magazine, and they have a website. But it's secretive because you and I can't join, no matter how much money we have. They only allow people in to join them who have that globalist outlook, okay? And they go back to the time of World War One, when Woodrow Wilson was trying to get into place the League of Nations, which is a forerunner of the United Nations. But it didn't work because the Senate of the United States said, I don't think we want to give up our sovereignty. So we declined to join, and it didn't quite work. So they formed the Royal Institute of International Affairs in England for the express purpose of trying to convince the public that we needed a United Nations. And the North American sister organization was the Council on Foreign Relations, and it all stemmed from the same socialists that were in Britain at that time. And then starting about the time of World War II, the State Department of the United States pretty well fell into the control of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they've been pretty well running U.S. foreign policy ever since. Vietnam came about because of all the 16 wise men all around Lyndon Johnson, and then same people going back through Kennedy, who were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, who back after World War II said the United States needed to gain control over the mineral resources of Southeast Asia, known as French Indochina at that time. And that's what got us into Vietnam. And it comes right on up till today. Of course, the inner core of the Council on Foreign Relations and its offshoot, because it was formed by CFR men, is the Trilateral Commission. And the inner core elite of these two organizations, they meet once a year as the Bilderbergers. And they're so secretive, they don't even have a proper name. They're called the Bilderbergers because they were first identified as meeting at the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland back in 1954. And so now Barack Obama has chosen Hillary Clinton to be his Secretary of State, and she has been attending these Bilderberg meetings, not just attending, but at the front door greeting the members as they come in, which is a time-honored method of introducing their protégés to the membership.
And isn't it true also that a lot of corporate CEOs and corporate heads, just people in very important positions of power and authority tend to come out of those two organizations or be involved
exactly,
by them?
Exactly. That's where it's all centered. In fact, see, you got to understand that the dictionary definition of fascism is the blending of state and corporate power. In my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, I even quote Benito Mussolini, the dictator in Italy during World War II, who's credited with coining the term fascism because of his black-shirted fascistas. And he said, actually, that's probably not the correct term. He said the more correct term is corporatism. In other words, rule by the corporations. And I ask you guys, isn't that pretty much what we see happening in America today?
Yeah, we do. I trace it back to Giuseppe Mazzini. And he actually originated, in my readings, fascism. And back then, during his days, it was a partnership between government and the trade guilds.
Right.
And the trade guilds have become the corporate interest now, which is overly dominating, more than dominating any government throughout the world.
You're absolutely correct. I was just bringing it up into more modern terms. And here's what's interesting. When I got to studying fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, I find that the difference seems to be is that in those two countries prior to World War II, the state, the political state, gained control over the corporations, and it was that blending of state and corporate power that produced fascism. In modern America, it seems the corporations have gained control over the state.
Yes, exactly. John Perkins, in his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, points that out very, very well in that book. We've interviewed him in the past.
Right. Yeah, he pretty well laid it on the line.
Yes, he did. When we're talking about the Fed today, then the Fed is still privately owned. Is this correct?
That's correct. It's 12 member banks are owned by other private banks, and these banks are owned by private citizens, many of whom are not even United States citizens. And every time we get into this, I keep thinking of Thomas Jefferson's writings, where he said, if we ever allow bankers to gain control over our money supply, our offspring will grow up without property in the country we founded.
Right, exactly.
And, if you guys look around, you see so many people that are living, paying a rent for an apartment, or they're paying rent or lease on a condominium, or they're paying on the car, and they're paying on their TVs and the radio. They really don't own anything.
Well, what we're talking about is credit. Isn't that really what we're talking about? Is the creation of credit from out of thin air. They have the power, a monopoly, to do that. Is that correctly?
That's pretty much correct. And we can see now, here over the past couple of months, where that's getting us.
Well, they've taken that to billions and, into the trillions, right?
Right. And then what kills me is, after these international bankers rape our economy, then they turn around and ask us to bail them out. And I am damned if we're not doing it.
Yeah, with more credit, right?
Yeah, give more credit.
That they're creating out of more thin air, right?
That's right. But hey, it's just tax money. Plenty more where that came
from. Oh, gosh, yeah. You know what? I came up with an answer to what thin air is, and it's the space-time continuum.
That's right.
And what they've done is they've created an idea that monopolizes that space-time continuum and everything within it.
Well, you have to go back and understand banking in the first place. Let's say that you've got $100 and you come to me and I say, hey, let me have all your money, George, and I'll keep it safe for you. You're just going to laugh me off. But if I build a big old building in steel and glass and I put up a big sign that says bank, and I say, here, George, let me keep your $100. Well, you go, okay, here you go. Now, do I keep your $100? No. I turn around and loan it to Charlotte. All right? So on the books, I gained your $100. That's an asset. But then I loaned it to Charlotte and went out the door, so now it's a debit. So actually, that $100 doesn't mean anything. All right?
Right.
Not making money for anybody,
okay,
except for the interest. Charging,
yes,
20% interest. So when Charlotte pays back the $100, she pays back $120. You come in and say, I want my $100 back, so I give you the $100 back. Now the $100 goes out as a debit, but it's come in as an asset plus $20. I've made $20 essentially by doing nothing.
Right. Yeah,
your money.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, it gets crazy, doesn't it? How about
now multiply that by trillions and you see where we are.
Yeah, let's move on to 9/11. You have here on the back of your book, was 9/11 an inside job? What's your best view on that right now?
Well, the absolute best light that you can put on 9/11, now that we know so much more than we knew in the weeks and months after the attacks of 9/11, is that the best light you can put on it is that certain people within our own government knew that we were about to be attacked and didn't do anything to stop it because it advanced their political agenda. Just as we now know that Franklin Roosevelt and his chief of staff, George Marshall, a handful of others, knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked. They knew when, they knew exactly what was going to happen, and they allowed it to happen because they needed a galvanized and aroused American public marching as one going into World War II.
Okay, we've got to take another break. We'll be right back. Let's continue that when we return. Thank you. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back, Jim Mars, author of Above Top Secret. At least that's your most recent book.
Right. What about this 9/11? You're saying that it has characteristics of a false flag, or it's operating much in the same way. What is your view on that?
That's exactly right. If you look at all of the evidence available, it's clear that more than 12 nations, including Castro in Cuba, including the Taliban in Afghanistan, tried to warn us that we were about to be attacked, and yet nothing was done. In fact, quite the contrary. During both the Clinton administration and the early Bush administration, steps were taken to block investigations by agents of the FBI and the CIA. They were prevented. In fact, John O'Neill, the FBI counterterrorism chief, got so frustrated with trying to warn and trying to investigate Osama bin Laden that he resigned from the FBI, was then offered a job as chief of security. Guess where? The World Trade Center.
So he died on that day, didn't he?
He died on that day. The one man who could probably tell us what was really going on. So the fact that they apparently knew and didn't do anything to stop it because it advanced their agenda, that's the best light you can put on it. When you really begin to look at the unanswered questions, the contradictions in the testimony, the problems they've had, the cover-ups that have gone on. When I say cover-ups, let's consider this. The day after Pearl Harbor, Congress convened a committee to find out what had happened. Less than a week after the Kennedy assassination, they'd formed the Warren Commission to try to investigate and find out what had happened. 2 years after 9/11, George W. Bush was still dragging his feet. And probably we wouldn't have any investigation to this day if it hadn't been for the Jersey girls and the families of some of those victims who just demanded that they look into it. So then they ended up with a investigation, the 9/11 Commission, that ended up spending $13 million to investigate the worst terrorist attack on American soil. Now, that's opposed to $60 million that was spent on George W. Bush's second election inaugural parties. Okay, so that gives you some kind of idea of the how important they thought these investigations were. And when you look at how they investigated, you find that they gave us a bunch of extraneous details, but in the 9/11 Commission report, they don't even mention Building 7, the third skyscraper that fell down in New York on that same day, about 5:30 in the afternoon, just dropped like a rock into its own foundation. How does a 47-story steel and glass modern skyscraper just drop down into its own foundation, barely damaging the two buildings to either side of it? That's a real conundrum. So how did they answer it? They didn't mention it. It's just amazing, folks. But let me tell you something. Having gone through the Kennedy assassination, there was a period of about 15 years between the 1963, November the 22nd, when Kennedy was shot in Dallas, all the way up into the late 70s, that it was just considered not polite or not socially acceptable to even talk about it. So there was this a period of about 15 years when there was just dead air in social discourse about what happened to Kennedy. Now, of course, it's all come out. Everybody's read all the books. Everybody's seen the movies. Everybody knows that there was a big question, big controversy, big conspiracy. Okay, well, we're going through the same thing today with 9/11. You're just not supposed to talk about it. And yet, when they finally start talking about it, you're going to find out 9/11 was an inside job.
Well, yeah, and
go ahead, Charlie.
So I would say one interesting aspect of this, Jim, that George actually brought to my attention last year. He was looking over the World Economic Summit out of Davos, and he found a term called sovereign wealth fund. And a sovereign wealth fund is a corporate type entity that kind of structures itself around natural resources.
Uh-huh.
There's one in Abu Dhabi, Alaska. I think there's 9 of them in total. But they are as powerful as nations, some nation states. And I've seen a lot of 9/11 researchers always frame this within the nation state boundary. And I feel like if we start investigating the sovereign wealth funds and where these people are connected, where these companies are connected, et cetera, I think that would be very fruitful.
Well, you know, Charlotte, that's the old journalism adage, follow the money.
Right.
You follow the money. And that's like, you know, Larry Silverstein and Westfield Properties that took out the 99-year lease on the two World Trade Center towers just less than 2 months before they were attacked. And first thing they did was hire a company called Securicom that was headed by Wirt Walker III, a member of the an in-law of the Bushes, and sitting on the board of directors was Marvin Bush, younger brother of George W. Bush. So the Bushes controlled the security company. And then they took out insurance policies, not with State Farm, but with Swiss Re, Allianz, the giant German insurance corporation, these multinational giant corporations. And then, all of a sudden, when the planes hit the buildings, they go to court and say, well, there were two planes hit two buildings, that's double indemnity. And they were trying to get for an investment of about $125 million that they put up on this 99-year lease that was to be $3.5 billion, I believe. But they'd only put up about $125 million. And so for their investment of $125 million, after all the negotiating was done, they ended up with $4.6 billion, which they, of course, had to share with the mortgage holder, and one of the outfits that's the largest mortgage holder was Blackstone Group, headed by the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. So you can see the level at which the money flowed, and now you can probably understand why we're not supposed to be talking about 9/11.
Exactly.
Or the subsequent wars and high-intensity conflicts that followed.
And everything that resulted from it.
Charlotte and I went up there on the financial summit to report on that on November 15th or so forth. We were flying out of there on the 17th, which was early Monday morning at 6 o'clock. I looked out the window to my left and saw the Pentagon lighted because it was still dark in Washington, D.C. at the time. And then saw that that memorial there for these benches for all those people that died on that plane. You know, and I thought to myself, instead of a memorial, it looked like a cemetery to me that they're burying this country.
Well, I think you may have something there. You know, pilots for 9/11 Truth have, and these are people who actually fly jets like those, and they have analyzed the radar data from the Pentagon that day, and they say that that plane never got lower than about 300 feet, so it went over the top of the Pentagon. Something else hit the Pentagon other than a Boeing 757. And I can pretty much vouch for that because I interviewed a woman, April Gallup, who with her small son was in the Pentagon, suffered through the explosion, and then crawled out through the hole in the west wall. And I submit to you that if that was a plane that exploded with such heat and intensity that it melted the wheel assemblies, the tail, the wings, and those
engines,
two-ton engines,
yeah,
then there's no way that April Gallup could have survived crawling out through that hole. But she did.
But destroying...
Go ahead. Or the DNA. Or the DNA identification of the victim.
Right.
How can you vaporize a plane, but yet get DNA?
But you got DNA. I know.
There would have been bodies and seats and fuselage parts all over the front of that building.
Folks, I've been to plane crashes, okay, probably more than my share as a reporter. And I tell you, I saw no evidence of a plane crash. I saw a few odd pieces of bent painted metal, but then those all seemed to appear after the initial photographs were taken of the front of the Pentagon. And then you see people running around with stuff covered over with tarps. And I had to wonder, you know, are they carrying stuff off or are they bringing stuff on?
Well, I tell you. You know what Charlotte Littlefield Brown did one time? She went to Stephenville and interviewed Steve Allen personally.
Yes.
George was there too.
I was her technician cameraman, okay, Jim?
Great.
I play all kinds of hats and jobs, you know.
We're going to talk Stephenville when we come back.
Yeah, we're going to touch on that too a little bit when we come back.
You know, it's still going on.
Well, I tell you, we've got some really good video on that in that in the office of Steve Allen. In fact, we've got some really good insights. We're going to be back here in about 6 to 8 minutes. This is the time to take a break and take care of the business of whatever you need to do at the top of the hour, and then we'll bring you back after that, Jim Mars. But thank you very much for being with us this evening. We'll be right back. Thank you.